Shalom. I am Leontine.
And I'm Alan.
Bruchim habaim. Welcome to our podcast, Yalla Israel. We invite you to discover the life and history of Israel, past, present, and future.
Yalla is a very popular slang expression in Israel, originating from Arabic, meaning, come on, let's go. So, yalla.
Shalom, Ellen. How are you today?
Shalom, Leontine. I'm wonderful.
Yes?
Shavua Tov. Good week.
Shavua Tov. A good week to you. So, guys, we're back in the Brown Hotel with podcast number 10. This is number 10, Ellen. We can celebrate our first anniversary. I can't believe it that we went so far already, but it's so fun to make this podcast. I enjoy it so much. What about you?
I love it. I love doing it with you, and I love talking about the country that you and I both love so much.
I agree. So how was your week?
It was a good week. I was actually guiding this week. And of course, any group that comes to Jerusalem, you usually take them to Yad Vashem, the memorial of the Shoah, the Holocaust. And I noticed something for the first time that I never noticed before, perhaps because it's new. But when I finished, and I know you're very familiar with Yad Vashem because you're actually one of their certified guides. When I finished the museum, you know, when you come out into the light, I noticed off in the distance, I saw a community that had like dozens and dozens of the steel crane, tall steel crane. Now, I don't know about you, but we've heard there's a common tour guide joke. You know, we ask, what is the national bird of Israel? And jokingly, we say it's the crane. But to come out of the Holocaust Museum and to see the building and development going on in Israel, which has been going on for 74 years, there's nothing more moving for me when you think of the revival of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, to see those cranes right as you exit the Yad Vashem Museum. So it was very touching for me.
Ah, that's very beautiful. You know that those cranes, that the city that you see is Mevaseret Zion, which means the announcer of Zion, which is also, I think, very symbolic when you come out of Yad Vashem and you see the announcer of Zion in front of you.
By the way, the national bird is not the crane. It's the hoopoe.
Hoopoe.
How was your week, Leontine?
Hoopoe. Oh, sorry. Hoopoe. My week is hoopoe. No, my hoopoe. My hoopoe. My week was good. What do you think of my t-shirt that I'm wearing? Isn't it cute?
It's adorable.
It's right. I feel like I'm talking to my husband, Shlomo, like men and fashion, it doesn't really go so well together.
The only difference is when you go home tonight, I hope he notices because I didn't.
I see on my phone, I'm receiving a message from your wife, Diane, and I see a message of Shlomo coming by in the same time. But anyway.
I think they're checking on us.
Probably. So my t-shirt, my lovely t-shirt, and we'll put a photo of the t-shirts with the podcast so you can see it. I bought it from Anat Friedman. So that was my week. When I think I merit a little present, I go to this beautiful little store of, I think, one of the rare true fashion designers that we have here in Jerusalem, Anat Friedman. Small shop, she works just above it, and she makes really nice clothes, and I bought this t-shirt for myself, so that was my week. It was a small treat. I worked a lot, and I deserved a nice t-shirt.
Kol hakavod. Yes, you do. All the power to you. You deserve a nice treat. Speaking of treats, ice cream, you scream. Israelis scream for ice cream. It's only appropriate that this week, this coming, I don't know, Monday or Tuesday, June 21st, is the first day of summer. And with the first day of summer, it's only appropriate that we talk about Israelis' fascination with ice cream. You know, it's such a fascination that there's even a saying in Israel, when you meet someone that you haven't seen in a long time, maybe once, maybe twice, on the second time you come across an old friend, you say, Pa'am Shlishit Glida. Glida is the Hebrew word for ice cream. It's the third time we meet, you buy me ice cream.
Ah, I didn't know that saying. That's very cute. So should we do it as well? Each time, the third time we meet, we offer each other ice cream?
No, because we see each other too many times. And besides, we eat ice cream all the time.
Well, you do. You do. Yes, ice cream is...
Hold on a second.
Yes.
That is... Take that back, because Diane's actually listening to the podcast. No. I do not eat ice cream all the time.
No secrets between me and Diane, so I'm sorry. Diane Allen does eat ice cream. So the ice cream, we know, as a matter of fact, that ice cream existed already in the history. We know that Alexander the Great, for instance, he loved to eat snow or ice covered with honey and nectar. Nectar is like a syrup, more or less. And we also know that King Solomon, he liked to eat, to drink iced drinks during harvesting. And I don't know if you remember, we also know that when the Crusaders were beaten at the Horns of Hittin in 1187 by Saladin. Saladin had the two leaders of the Crusaders sitting in front of him, and one of them was very arrogant and was very thirsty, and he asked him for an iced drink. And then Saladin brought the drink, head cut off of the guy who asked for it, and gave it to the other guy who was very low-key and decided not to ask for anything. So it can be a tragedy also to have ice cream. Of course, we are here in a hot country, so it is a kind of a passion here. And people are having ice cream all the time. When you're walking in the streets, people are eating ice cream everywhere and all the time.
Well, I think when you mentioned, you just gave us a wonderful history lesson. You told me stories that some I had forgotten and some I never knew. But maybe Solomon and Alexander and Salah ad-Din, when they got here, they could not have imagined a place more unbearably hot. You know, we've talked about in previous podcasts how it does not rain from April until October. The fact that it doesn't rain isn't what makes it hot. It's that sun. It's so hot that you have to cool down with a tasty cold treat. In my family, we never end a hike without ice cream. I told my four daughters all the times when they'd be moaning and groaning as we're climbing and walking through the heat, that there will always be ice cream at the end of the hike. And sure enough, in Israel, there's such a fascination that no matter how deep in the woods you are, or how off the beaten track you go, there's always going to be either an ice cream truck or a kiosk wherever you go. I find what's incredible about the ice cream here, of course, we sell a lot of gelato from Italy, because Italy's are the masters at making ice cream. I love gelato. Do you love gelato?
I love it. I my preferred taste is stracciatelli, I think it's called. It's vanilla with pieces of chocolate inside. Oh, it's so good.
It's delicious, but gelato is incredible, and there's nothing that can compare, including ice cream in Israel. However, I think we have taken it a step further with some of the flavors that we sell here. If you think about it, we talked about Shfaram. Remember when we were in Shfaram after we visited Usha?
Yes.
And we ate their lemon and their pistachio. But they also have interesting flavors. They have halava. You know the halava flavor ice cream?
You say halava?
Halava?
No, it's halva.
Halva. You say tomato, I say tomato.
Okay, halava.
Halava.
Okay,
what did not? I say? Halva? Halva?
You said halava, but I say halava. Okay. Yeah, halva ice cream is to die for.
They also have an ice cream, labana.
Yes.
You're probably going to say it's not labana, it's labna.
Labane. Labane.
Okay, it's like a sour goat cheese, delicious. And of course, they have to have a za'atar ice cream. That's the spice za'atar.
Ah, I never tasted that one. Is it good?
I don't like za'atar, so I don't like that ice cream.
You say za'atar, I say za'atar. Okay,
say it again.
Za'atar.
Za'atar, like a ch at the end? Oh, za'atar. Oh, you say it like the locals say it.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm not from around here.
True. Me neither.
But my favorite.
I act as if I'm
my favorite
around.
Of all the ice cream flavors. Not my favorite that I like, but the idea of it is that there's actually a hummus ice cream.
No.
Yes.
Is it disgusting?
You know, I mentioned in a previous broadcast that some people even use hummus here for deodorant.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, why not ice cream?
Yeah. So, you know, Johanna, my youngest daughter, she came here when she was 18. She worked for 1 year in a kibbutz and... learning Hebrew and so on. And then she went to the army for two years. where she was a helicopter mechanic. And then the year after the army, for 1 year, she was working and traveling, like what a lot of Israeli kids do before starting her studies. And guess where she worked? In an ice cream store in Tel Aviv, right across from where we lived.
That can be very dangerous.
Yes. So I would go to see her very often and get a nice ice cream. So that was a very nice experience.
Do you remember the name of the ice cream place?
Siciliana.
Siciliana, was it good? Was it
very good? Yeah, they had some very good ice cream. They made it themselves.
They did. So, do you have a favorite ice cream in Israel?
In the end, I always end up taking either a sorbet if I try to stay light, you know, fruit, something like that, or a stracciatelli if they have it. I end up taking the same always.
No, but it's a favorite. Do you have a favorite ice cream?
A store,
yes.
Yeah, Otello. Otello. Also, they don't have them in Jerusalem yet. Otello, come to Jerusalem.
I love the Otello. They put the chocolate in the cone. They drip the fountain chocolate.
It's so good.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites too, but I have a sentimental favorite. My sentimental favorite is a place called Penguin. I think I took you there.
Yes, you took me there. I remember it.
Okay, so Penguin... first of all, it's incredible ice cream, and you get they give you very large scoops for for almost no shekels. But when I was in Israel as a high school student, I went to high school in Israel, which was in Hoda Sharon, on a campus called Mosenson. And we would go and get falafel at the Blue Falafel.
Well, you took me there also.
Yeah, but that's for another podcast.
Yes.
And later in the evening, we would take the bus. I think it was like the 25 bus to Kfar Saba. And in Kfar Saba, there was a family that had been making ice cream for 50 years, making it homemade in the back of the shop. And it was Penguin ice cream. And it to this day, I remember the ice cream, so it's got a sense of nostalgia for me, and I was so excited to take you and Shmuel there.
Yeah.
During the pandemic,
it was great, and the owner, the founder, was there, right? An old man.
Yeah. He was sitting in the back,
and telling the young girl who worked there how to surface. It was an amazing place. So ice cream, it is so good. We are sitting here in the Brown Hotel, and you know, Louis has to work. He's taking ice out of the fridge. There you go. The Brown Hotel, who is very nice, letting us record in the bar. And the barman, Louis, poor guy, he has to deal and do his bar work somewhere else.
Louis actually closed down the bar this morning, and he'll reopen the bar for the guests at 7 this evening. Thank you, Louis.
Absolutely. Thank you, Louis. And Louis is going to take a picture of us so you can see my beautiful t-shirt from Anat Friedman. And in the meantime, our off-the-beaten-track site today is Nachsholim. Nachsholim, I already mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. It is my favorite place in Jerusalem. It is the most beautiful beach.
I think that's when my mother-in-law, Marilyn, asked the question of what was our favorite place we visited during the pandemic. And I wasn't bold enough to commit to a particular site because I have hundreds.
Yeah.
But you unabashedly and without hesitation said Nachsholim.
Nachsholim. Nachsholim. If I could live there tomorrow, I guess I would go there. Nachsholim is a kibbutz, a real kibbutz, like the kibbutzim that you have here in Jerusalem with the kibbutz system. It sits on the beach. The beach is beautiful, beautiful, like little bays with sand and rock around it. It is also a very important historical place with ruins that go back to the Phoenician and the Greek period and so on. There is an old abandoned glass factory that was turned into a museum. and a hotel, so you can actually stay there. If you cannot be living in the kibbutz, you can actually live there for the time of a weekend, for instance, and enjoy the life in Nachsholim. So Nachsholim is an amazing place, and that is the place that we're going to talk to you about.
So the museum is a wonderful place to begin a trip to Nachsholim, and then the archaeology. But the most beautiful part, in my opinion, of that area is the what we call today the Dor HaBonim Beach. It's actually a nature reserve extending from Nachsholim all the way to HaBonim. Is that right? Is it HaBonim or to Dor?
To HaBonim.
HaBonim. So there's a stretch of beach from the kibbutz of Nachsholim all the way to the community of HaBonim. Now it's incredibly beautiful because it's made of the karkur, the stone, the calcified sand that makes these sharp cliffs. And when you walk along this reserve, you can climb the rocks and you can climb into pools. And they have hidden coves. It's a series of coves that connect to one another, and you can find plenty of privacy, beautiful blue water, and sometimes without a lot of waves, so you can wade in the water. It's just incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, it is. So the kibbutz itself was established in 1948 by Palmach soldiers that had fought during the War of Independence, and they were joined by Shoah survivors, in fact, and they are the ones that build up the kibbutz. Now, the museum that we talked about, what do we see in the museum? Because we haven't talked about that. What do you see in the museum is what they found in the water. So when you, because that's something that everybody dreams of course, is that you're diving a little bit in the water and then you find something. And they found a lot because Dor, where the ruins are, was an important harbor at one point, a Phoenician harbor. And so they found remains of the harbor. And of course, where you have a harbor, you have ships that went down, you have goods that fell off the ships and into the water. So they have found a lot of treasures in the sea. And that is what you can see in the museum.
You remember when we walked around the port, all the remains,
yeah,
and the cliffs, and the kids were jumping off the...
Yes,
the port into the water there.
Yes, I think, and that is maybe the most touching thing that I saw there is that at three, when the children of the kibbutz come out of school, they all put on their bathing suits and they go and surf.
Oh yeah, I have that picture of all those kids carrying the surfboards and, yeah, the boats going to after school surf and sailing school.
Hard life.
It's a hard luck life, but a good life.
Now, we always finish a tour with eating. We didn't talk about it the last time.
The last two times, but whenever we go off the beaten track, you always have to find off the beaten track places of fine and not so fine dining.
Exactly.
Road food, good food is what we call it. I remember this one. We actually had a picnic. Remember our picnic that we had on the beach?
Yeah, it was delicious. So... And we did go to this little hummus place, and the hummus was so good. So this is where I took Ellen and Shmuel and Eva to. We bought a lot of hummus. We bought also other things. I don't remember what we got. Maybe falafel. But anyway, the hummus there was amazing.
We got the hummus. We got the falafel at different stores there right off the road in Ferraris. And of course, every good Arabic meal should be topped off with some sweet, usually halava, but in this case it was kanafe, delicious.
So, halava, I say halva, you say kanafe, I say knafe.
So the question this week from our subscriber comes from Rebecca in Virginia, and she wants to know, are there still kibbutzes in Israel?
So it's a good question. And, you know, we just talked about Nachsholim, and Nachsholim is a kibbutz. We talked last time, I believe, about Zikim. Zikim is also a kibbutz. So there are a few hundred kibbutzes, we say kibbutzim, still in Israel, but they don't, very few still function like the original kibbutz system. So a kibbutz is like a collective, I would say, a commune. Everybody shares, everybody works for the kibbutz. You don't get a salary. The kibbutz takes care of everything. That is very, very rare that this system still exists, but the name for a community called the kibbutz still exists. Yes, it was really a socialist idea that came with the pioneers, the immigrants that came here in the early 1900s. And the very first kibbutz was actually not called a kibbutz, but a small group, a kvutza, was founded in Degania in 1909. It was just 12 guys, actually 12 people, 10 guys and 2 girls that started a collective farm, basically. And a little bit later, in 1921, the first real kibbutz was opened, Ein Harod, which is in the Jezreel Valley. The idea of a kibbutz was that, like I said, everybody works for the kibbutz, everything is shared. You don't get a salary, but you do get an apartment, you get food, there is a collective car, the study for the children are being paid by the kibbutz. There was a children house where the children were educated and brought up as a collective, and they would see their parents once a day. So this kind of kibbutz doesn't exist anymore, but there are some kibbutzim that still try to live according to a certain model of socialism. But as somebody said, socialism is very nice if you have a lot of money. The problem is that the kibbutzim were losing a lot of money. And I think in the 1980s, there was a law adopted where the Knesset decided to cancel all the debts, like the millions and millions of shekels of debts that the different kibbutzim had. And from then on, they became more capitalist, I would say.
Yeah. So speaking of this shift from egalitarianism into capitalism, or more privatization, those kibbutzes that were able to adapt in this new world order, some of them, there are actually some very shining, there are some shining stars, what we like to call, and I want to point out a few of them. The first one is when you're driving either up from a lot or down to a lot, you pass a kibbutz called Yotvata. Remember we saw Yotvata?
Yes, yes.
Yotvata across the street, you can actually stop at their dairy cafe and they sell ice cream because they made millions and millions of dollars selling dairy products. One of their top selling products is Shoko. Shoko, which is chocolate milk. So every member of that kibbutz is now they're millionaires of the kibbutz. And there's also, I mentioned in a previous, I don't know if it was this episode or the last episode, we talked about Caesarstone.
Yes.
The Caesarea, Kibbutz Caesarea, started this manufacturing of the Caesarstone. They actually started out in their egalitarian life, their former life, they were a fish pond. They were a fishery. And then they eventually got into this exporting of the Caesarstone. And today they're very successful. We have others. When we were in the startup nation, we had many kibbutzim that delved into high tech. One in particular is actually called a kibbutz Yisrael. Speaking of the Jezreel Valley, where the first kibbutz was, Ein Harod, there's actually a kibbutz Yisrael that sells, I think it's pool sweeps. Okay, they got into manufacturing of pool cleaners, swimming pool cleaners.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've been very successful. And the original success story is there was a product called Netafim. Do you remember Netafim? Does that ring a bell?
No.
Netafim was from the kibbutz Hazarim in the Negev that came up with the idea and invented drip irrigation.
Ah, of course. Yes.
So while the kibbutzim are minimal these days, maybe 200 or 300, not many. By the way, they were never many. They were probably less than 10% of the population, even at their heyday. But today, they're different. But some of them have succeeded. quite nicely.
Yeah, and if you come to back to Israel, or if you come to Israel for the first time, do ask us to bring you to a kibbutz. There are several kibbutzim that you can go and you just drive through and you already get a good idea, but you can also have lunch or dinner in their kibbutz dining room. And then you really get the feeling of having a meal in a kibbutz, like in the good old days. For instance, Zikim, the kibbutz that we talked about in our previous episode, you have a old-fashioned dining room there. Ein Gedi, that we go by very often, you have an old-fashioned dining room there as well. And as a tourist, you can actually come, pay for the meal, and eat with the kibbutznik.
I would like to take you to my family, my Israeli family's kibbutz, Ein HaShofet.
Yeah, take me. Thank you for listening to Yalla Israel. As always, you can find us on Spotify, Buzzsprout, or your favorite podcast app. You can send questions or contact us on Instagram @YallaIsraelPodcast. Talk to you next week.